Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, tracking COVID. On Wednesday, the Trump administration ordered hospitals to report COVID patient data to an HHS contractor instead of the CDC. Critics warn the move puts extra burdens on the hospital staff. Many others who've been relying on regular updates from the CDC on COVID-19 trends fear HHS may not make the data as readily available to the public. Sarah Clip is an investigative reporter for the New York Times. She focuses on the American healthcare system and how it works for patients. She joins me to talk about COVID-19 reporting systems and their critical importance in the ongoing effort to control spread of the virus. Sarah, on Wednesday, the Trump administration announced that hospitals would, effective immediately, be required to report data not to the Centers for Disease Control, but instead to Health and Human Services. Yesterday, the National Governors Association and others said hospitals are not ready to make this change, needed extra time. Explain what kind of data we're talking about.
Yeah, so this data is all about tracking the country's capacity to manage coronavirus. This is data, it comes from thousands of facilities on how many hospital beds they have, how many coronavirus patients they're treating, how many ventilators they have on hand. It's supposed to give you a picture of, you know, what are the areas in the country that might be facing some sort of crisis, might be running out of space. And you're right, Diane, there was this surprise announcement very quietly too, just kind of in a routine sort of rule that went out that changed who the data is reported to, changed it from the Centers for Disease Control to Health and Human Services. The Trump administration has said this is to improve the data, that some of the systems in CDC are antiquated, that this will help them kind of centralize the data, make it more useful. But you're right, the governors are worried, and public health officials, I'd say, are also a little bit worried about this change, how quickly it's done, that it wasn't very transparent, and that they, governors, are asking for another month of delay on these requirements so hospitals can actually get ready and learn the new system as they are also managing a pandemic in their midst.
I'm really interested that you said this announcement was issued so quietly. It looks to me as though it's a very important announcement. So what do you make of the fact that it was done so quietly?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little hard to tell, but this isn't, you know, there are things that are happened that I cover where a press release goes out to media where they want to tell you, here's the thing we're doing. But these were just instructions that were posted on the Department of Health and Human Services website. You know, it took a little while until one of my colleagues noticed them to realize, oh, this was actually a significant change. And it's hard to know whether the Trump administration really does see this as just a technical reporting change, or if there is going to be some kind of change in data, if this data is going to become less available to the public when it is controlled by HHS. There's also a bit of a worrisome sign. Yesterday, some reporters at the outlet ProPublica noticed that this dashboard that has been running for a long while showing hospital capacity suddenly went offline without any explanation. It's back online now, but those kind of things happening without notice, without any sort of public announcement, it is a little bit worrisome, and it might suggest that the administration doesn't want to draw attention to these changes it's making.
So the process in place at the CDC, some people said, was less than ideal. Talk about why.
So what the administration has said, and you know, this is something I've been reporting on a little bit, is that it's a very laggy system, that they said it takes about a week from their reporting to actually processing the data in the CDC system. And they are saying that they have this new system within HHS that'll be much more real time. We don't know a lot about that system though. You know, we don't know a ton about those differences. This is what has been said. But again, it's not a very transparent change at this point. But the rationale, at least from the Trump administration's perspective, is to make this data move faster and get rid of some of the reporting lags they say they've been seeing in the CDC system.
And what about entering data manually? Hasn't that been a big lag time problem?
Yeah, so this is something I've been writing about, that one of the things we're learning public health officials are really challenged by now is the really patchwork system that is used to report medical lab results. It turns out these results are being mailed, faxed, emailed, some reported electronically, some reported by phone call, but there's a ton of manual data entry involved, particularly for the results that come in by fax, the results that come in over the phone. The problem has gotten so bad that Washington State has actually brought on 25 members of the National Guard just to do manual data entry. That's not usually what you think of the National Guard doing, but that is a pressing national concern right now, is how do we get all this data into these really old public health systems that are just overwhelmed by the avalanche of coronavirus tests they're getting.
So does changing the system and having data go directly to HHS help out any of those problems?
So it doesn't, because there are actually two different data sets that we're talking about. The data that HHS is going to be holding on to, that's hospital data about how many people are in the hospital, how many ventilators they have, what sort of coronavirus outbreak they're dealing with in their ICU. The manual data entry, that really relates to the coronavirus tests that we're having. And I think it speaks to the really fragmented way America's healthcare system works, where you have, you know, one reporting system that's dealing with people in the hospital, another reporting system dealing with tests. Both are very, very clunky. They don't really talk to each other in any significant way. So these new changes at the federal level, they're not going to address the manual data entry challenges that are happening at the local public health level.
Okay. Am I wrong when I say that the concern here among officials at the CDC is that this data might, number one, be withheld from the public, and number two, might be somehow altered by the White House or somehow changed to reflect better outcome?
I think that's exactly the concern we're hearing from public health officials. Traditionally, it is the role of the CDC to handle public health data and analyze it and make it public. It is not traditionally the role of Health and Human Services to do that. So I think those are exactly the questions being raised by some outside observers of, why is this change happening? Why is it happening now? Is the data going to be accurate? And are we going to have access to that data? And will there be some kind of audit? Will the CDC still get some sort of access and transparency? You know, this change only happened 2 days ago, so we're still watching to see what happens there. But you're exactly right. Those are the concerns being raised right now.
But the CDC was trusted in this regard, was it not?
You know, they have been. I think the CDC has had seen some declines in public trust through the coronavirus outbreak. There, you know, I think that really traces back to some of these test kits they set out in February that were flawed and really slowed the agency's and the country's response to coronavirus. So traditionally, this has been the role of CDC. CDC is typically seen as a pretty nonpartisan, strong government agency that is out to protect the public health. But you've seen a little bit of an erosion of that trust over the past few months. And it seems like that might continue with kind of taking this data away from them with this latest move.
Is HHS going to receive data that's not open to the public?
So that is a question we are still watching for. We are going to watch and see whether this information about hospitals, about how many people are in the hospitals, what capacity they have, if they continue to report that. You know, ProPublica did notice yesterday some of the reporting dashboards went down. These dashboards that show ICU capacity by state, you know, were no longer online on Thursday. They've since been restored after that story ProPublica broke, got a lot of attention, but that seems to suggest a sign there may be differences in the data that the public has access to with this reporting change.
So the concerns about HHS then are being addressed by members of Congress. For example, you've got Patty Murray of Washington, the senior Democrat on the Senate Health Panel, talking about why these changes are happening. You've got Senator Bob Menendez of New Jersey saying, we will look at withholding funding until the administration changes course. So this quiet little announcement seems to have waved the waters quite a bit.
I think it has. And I think this thing, you know, is going to be subject to a lot of scrutiny. People are going to notice when a dashboard goes down, when data is being reported differently. And I think what you're seeing Democrats argue, and you're seeing this from state health officials too, is they're saying that only CDC has the expertise to analyze this data, that the entire thing that they do is, you know, identify and detect and track diseases. And I think it's going to be under a lot of scrutiny, and, you know, not reporting this data publicly, it's going to draw a lot of attention, you know, even if the Trump administration didn't want it going that way, wasn't planning to do some large rollout for this change.
Sarah, you wrote about fax machines in medicine 3 years ago. Talk about how fax machines may now be part of the problem.
So this is something, you know, I both as a reporter and, you know, a patient, I'm kind of obsessed with, is why we are constantly being asked to fax things to our doctors or receive things by fax. Most of us don't have fax machines anymore, but the fax machine is very alive and well in medicine. And the reason why that is because doctors, they do have digital systems, but those systems don't really talk to each other. Chances are, if you go to one hospital and it has a digital record and you want to go to another hospital with a digital record, there's not going to be an easy way to transfer that data digitally. Probably what will happen is someone will make a printout and fax it. And what we're seeing is that lack of digital interoperability, it really, really matters for our coronavirus response too. The way that reporting traditionally works is medical laboratories do coronavirus tests, and then they report those positive results to their local health department. The problem is they generally don't have the technology to transfer that data digitally or transfer it, you know, straight into a public health reporting system. So what happens is they fax the information, or they send these big spreadsheets that someone in the public health end has to go through and, you know, copy and paste the spreadsheet into the public health reporting system. It's always been this kind of creaky system that worked when you had a normal amount of test results. But now public health officials, they have an avalanche of coronavirus test results. Yeah. And they're just getting overwhelmed by the amount of data they have to manage that isn't coming in a digital fashion.
So yesterday, on Thursday, when asked about delays in getting test results, the White House said it's now up to the states to figure this. But how?
It's hard. I mean, we are aware of one state, Washington, that has brought in the National Guard to help with their data entry issues. Yeah. You know, other ones, like, they're trying their best, but they're literally battling exploding fax machines, like fax machines that are just shooting paper out onto the floor because so many results are coming in. And, you know, this is exactly what we've done for decades, is told states, okay, you know, you manage your data systems, you figure it out, but we haven't really given them funding to update them. We haven't required that medical laboratories create software that can directly talk to public health software. So we've been leaving the public health departments on their own for years, and we're seeing that in the midst of a pandemic, that approach leads to a lot of lags and a lot of slow reporting.
Are these mechanical systems a large part of the problem, or do you see it as a leadership problem?
So I think it's a whole bunch of things. I think the mechanical problems are definitely part of it. Another thing I think about is just the structure of the American healthcare system, which is so much more fragmented than most of our peer countries. You know, we have this zany system where millions are uninsured and people get insurance all sorts of ways. And that fragmentation, that comes into play with the data. You know, one thing that a lot of our peer countries have is they have a unique identifier for every single patient in their healthcare, almost like a social security number for healthcare. And that makes it really easy when a lab gets a result with that number on it, they know exactly who it belongs to. we do not have those identifiers. Congress has passed laws specifically barring the government from creating those identifiers, which means that if a result comes in with a letter missing or the phone number is not there or the patient's name is spelled slightly wrong, it's really hard to figure out who that person is that the information belongs to. So, you know, all of this is happening in this landscape of a healthcare system that is incredibly fragmented, where different actors aren't used to talking to each other. On top of that, I think it is certainly fair to say you have seen, you know, leadership failures in terms of mask wearing, in terms of, you know, locking down when you need to lock down. It's all sorts of things that are kind of this perfect storm that lets coronavirus get, you know, just yesterday, my colleagues reported, we once again broke the record for number of cases. That's 74,000 cases in one day alone. That's pretty astonishing.
And you have the governor of Georgia bringing a case against the mayor of Atlanta for demanding that people wear masks. Mm-hmm. And the governor of Georgia saying, no, you can't do that. I'm going to bring a suit again. We have to be the laughingstock of the world when you see stuff like that going on.
Yeah, I mean, it's really like no other country where the mask wearing has become so politicized and polarized. You know, some of my colleagues at the Times put out a map today where they surveyed 250,000 Americans about their mask wearing habits, and you just see huge, huge variation. And there certainly are correlations with political views in terms of who is wearing masks and who is not. And it leads to those conflicts you're mentioning, where you have cities in crisis, cities where coronavirus is rising, trying to pass mask mandates. And then you run into the, you know, surprising politics of this issue, where it becomes an issue of freedom and personal choice. And you have governors like Governor Kemp saying, you know, no, you can't create those. The public health battle has really spilled into a political battle in a way that's different in the United States than other countries.
On the issue of foreign students having to have in-class time in order to stay in this country, the administration, when all the backlash mm-hmm. came, reversed itself. Do you see any chance of that happening with this reporting data mm-hmm. to HHS?
It's certainly possible. I think that's one of the things we've seen over the past few months is that policy can move very quickly and a backlash can really matter. I will say one of the things I think that was crucial with that student visa issue was they immediately faced litigation over it. And that was the context in which we saw the decision reversed. We haven't seen any litigation yet about these reporting requirements. I'm not totally sure who it would come from. It might you know, be more about transparency issues that come up in the future. But that is one, you know, contextual difference I think that was important and really crucial to the change in the policy around student visas.
More from Sarah Cliff when we come back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture,
and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with Sarah Cliff of the New York Times. Sarah, what about access to insurance? You mm-hmm. wrote recently about how voters in Oklahoma, mm-hmm. decidedly a red state, voted to expand Medicaid per the Affordable Care Act. Do you see this as part of a trend?
I definitely do. One of the things we've been watching over the past few years is, you know, Republicans for more than a decade now have been attempting to repeal the Affordable Care Act, but you're starting to see their voters embrace it. And exactly where you see this is Medicaid expansion. You've now had five states, generally those run by Republican governors, where the legislature and the governor have declined to participate in Medicaid expansion, five states where there's been a ballot initiative, and every single time these ballot initiatives to expand Medicaid pass. And I think Oklahoma is really notable because it is such a red state. It's a state that Trump carried very easily. And this is a state that voted to bring more of Obamacare into its state so it could give more low-income Oklahomans health insurance. I think I'll be watching in August. Missouri has a very similar ballot initiative to expand Medicaid there. That'll be another test. And the organizers I've talked to, they think, you know, on the one hand, coronavirus, it's making people more aware of the importance of health insurance, the importance of expanding the safety net, and that is going to increase support. At the same time, they're worried about turnout. They're worried about these ballot initiatives happening in a moment when Americans are very nervous to leave their homes. But even in that context, we did see Oklahoma, a very, very conservative state, you know, essentially its voters embrace a key plank of the Affordable Care Act.
And Wyoming, same thing. What's happening there?
Yeah, Wyoming is taking a new look at Medicaid expansion. Right now, there's about a dozen states that haven't expanded Medicaid, the major ones being Texas and Florida. Those are the places where you see the most uninsured Americans at this point. And I think you will see some renewed interest in Medicaid expansion as millions of Americans are losing insurance. There's a study that came out earlier this week estimating that 4.5 million Americans have become uninsured in the midst of this economic downturn. But the thing that cuts against that is states' budgets are really, really strapped right now, and they're expected to pay a small share of their Medicaid expansion costs, 10% of whatever it costs to bring health insurance to their residents. So I think you see state legislators in these states that haven't expanded a little torn. You know, Medicaid expansion is more important now than ever before, but they also are dealing with these budgets that, you know, they're going to have a lot of trouble if they're putting more money towards school, for example, to make their schools work, you know, in a socially distanced way. Their state budgets are going to be really, really strapped to find the money they need to sign up for Medicaid expansion.
So all of this happening at the same time the Trump administration is asking the Supreme Court to overturn all of Obamacare, including the Medicaid expansion.
Yeah, so this is a lawsuit that has been kind of moving through the federal courts over the past few years. It feels like as long as Obamacare has existed and I've been covering it, there have always been court cases against it, you know, three of which have made it up to the Supreme Court. And this case essentially argues the entire Affordable Care Act is unconstitutional, and it was successful in a federal court. They've had one judge rule in their favor, and there's now a push, you know, to move it expedited up to the Supreme Court. And the Trump administration, they're essentially arguing that the main pillars of the Affordable Care Act, this ban on pre-existing conditions and requirement to give everyone health insurance, that all of that is illegal and should fall. So that's a case, you know, we're really watching quite closely, and one that the Trump administration has stuck with, you know, somewhat surprisingly. The pre-existing condition protections in the Affordable Care Act are incredibly popular with both Republicans and Democrats. So it's been a little bit surprising to me that they've decided to continually take aim at that part of the law.
And especially now, when more and more people need that insurance, are they bound and determined still to move forward?
They are. You know, they filed briefs just a few weeks ago, along with a large group of Republican attorneys general. They filed briefs with the Supreme Court asking them to take this case. So they are just as nothing about coronavirus has changed the view of Republican attorney generals or the Trump administration on the merits of this lawsuit.
How soon do you think the court could take that up, if?
Mm-hmm. So it looks like it'll probably be after the election, which is kind of the key date that I think about here. We started seeing some of the orders from the Supreme Court for their fall term. It is possible, but seems unlikely at this point, that we'll hear this case before next spring at the earliest.
Surely Supreme Court justices read the newspaper and know what's going on in this world. You know, it's hard to believe that people would think about taking away any kind of health insurance during this crisis, which could last for years.
Yeah. And it's made the health insurance landscape in the United States so fraught. You know, most Americans get their health insurance at work. And I've talked to some with some pretty serious pre-existing conditions who feel like they have this really horrendous choice in front of them. You know, they are immunocompromised and, you know, they are nervous about going back to their jobs because of the health risks, but they also feel like they can't afford not to go back to their jobs because if they don't go back to their jobs, they're going to lose the health insurance that they absolutely need for their health condition. So it feels like such a catch-22 that some of these workers are in. And it would be very different. You know, I think this is a real, this economic downturn and the coronavirus pandemic, it's the first recession that the Affordable Care Act has existed for. So we're really going to see how that changes the safety net and what it does for Americans having these programs that were not in place in previous recessions. And I think so far we're already seeing increased signups for the Medicaid program, increased enrollments in the health laws marketplaces. You do see this safety net kind of coming into play in a pretty significant way.
If Obamacare were overturned, what would happen to those people who are now insured in that way and probably are out of work to begin with?
So they would most likely lose their coverage. You know, one of the things we do hear from the administration, from Republican legislators, is that, you know, if Obamacare were struck down, there would be a replacement plan. They would legislate, they would create something new. I would also contextualize that by saying that Republicans have had many, many chances to create that plan, come up with a plan that they like, that their caucus supports, that they can move through Congress, and have not been able to do that. You know, most notably in 2017, when they controlled the Senate, the House, and the White House, you know, and they made a real, real push at Obamacare repeal. They spent months and months on it. They were not able to come up with a plan that they could get enough votes for. So there is a claim from Republican legislators that, look, we'd have a replacement plan. These people would not be left out in the cold. But we have not seen evidence yet that they are able to successfully create and pass a replacement plan. And the replacement plans that have been offered so far, they insure millions fewer Americans than the Affordable Care Act currently covers.
And that surely is going to affect the country's economy overall, really dreadfully, it would seem.
Yeah, yeah. If you have Americans who aren't able to get the healthcare treatment they need, you know, that's a huge drag on the economy, particularly if we are, you know, still battling coronavirus. You're going to have people who want to get tested, people who need access to the coronavirus vaccine. You worry about people not getting the health services they need. And in this case, health services that affect other Americans because they're the type of services that stop the coronavirus's spread. You worry about those services not getting to Americans due to financial hardship.
Sarah, people are asking, why are we not hearing more from Republicans on the Hill? Why are we not hearing more from Democrats on the Hill? What is the thinking that's going on Capitol Hill? And why isn't there more outspokenness from both sides on what's happening?
Well, I mean, I do think you see a fair amount of work in legislating. We've seen some of the, you know, fastest stimulus and relief packages passed in March to kind of address the economy. But I think you're right. It does feel like a bit of an absence right now as we're looking at the enhanced unemployment benefits are just about to expire. There's talk of a new relief package, but it doesn't seem like there's a ton of movement on that. We might see that in the next few weeks. It does feel like there's been like a little bit of a lull in legislating. But I will say, you know, I do think we are still hearing from legislators. We heard from many, many legislators about this reporting change, for example, and on how the Trump administration is asking for hospital data to be reported. So I think they are still on alert, watching things. But the next time we, you know, see something larger from the Hill will likely be whatever is the next relief package that they set on. And that'll matter a lot. Those sort of policies they've been creating, you know, have been really crucial to keeping people afloat at this moment.
Sarah, it would seem we're at a tipping point in being able to control the spread of the virus. Does it seem that way to you as well?
It feels like we may have tipped already in a lot of ways. You know, I'm watching the dashboard that my colleagues at the Times created where they track the number of cases, and we're seeing, you know, the highest number of cases, new highs set, you know, multiple times this month for how many coronavirus cases are in the United States. We're seeing, you know, Florida has surpassed New York as the state with the highest one-day total. And we're quickly, you know, kind of on our way to a school year that's very abnormal, where schools are not going to be able to open because of how widespread the virus is. It feels like in a lot of ways, you know, we've already in many places in the United States kind of tipped and are watching the consequences of that.
Before we close, is there anything else you'd like to say to our listeners?
Is there anything else I'd like to say? Wear a mask. We've seen from public health officials shows that it's actually a pretty important technique to keeping the virus at bay. So I am wearing my mask, and I hope others are too.
Sarah, thank you.
Thank you.
That was Sarah Cliff. She's an investigative reporter for the New York Times. She focuses on the American healthcare system and how it works for patients. And that's all for today. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Sandra Baker, Rebecca Kaufman, and Allison Brody. Thanks for listening, all, and please do wear a mask. I'm Diane Rehm.